Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have the great Swede, Stefan Johansson, one of the sport's just peerless characters. I go to Steph for thoughts and opinions about so many things, and knowing how much I've appreciated his career, his completely unfiltered views on life, the sport, and everything in between, I've been meaning to get together with Steph for about a year, actually, to capture a Life and Origins podcast. We did this at the Long Beach Grand Prix in April, on April 9th, and by chance, happened to capture part two 7 months later to the day, here in November, so there is a part two of Life and Times of Stefan Johansson. So this is a guy who has raced, in my estimation, some of the greatest cars, if not the greatest collection of cars and eras imaginable in motor racing. So we have someone who has raced in Formula One in the turbo era and non-turbo era for McLaren, for Ferrari, and a lot of lesser known and or ones he would want to forget. He has raced in the CART IndyCar series during its peak in the mid and late 1990s. This is someone who has raced at Le Mans and won at Le Mans. This is someone who has raced in GT cars. This is someone who is unique, in my opinion, in the fact that he has raced with the proverbial 1,000 horsepower plus turbo motors back in the 1980s and did so when CART was reaching that mythical, magical 1,000 horsepower number in the 1990s too. So you put all that together and you realize that Steph has, he's driven things that we dream of from Monaco to the Indy 500 to the 24 Hours of Le Mans, just incredible. So getting down with Steph, learning about his upbringing and where motor racing came into his life in Sweden, and then also some of the crazy things. This is a person who, I think many of us remember him for his first exploits in F1 with the crazy Spirit Honda team. The Spirit program was chosen by Honda as a very low-risk, low-grade entry point for its turbocharged engines. Well, before that, while Steph was in Formula 3 on his way to winning the 1980 British Formula 3 title, he got the call-up to F1. And so, at least here in America, it's the equivalent of going for that Pro Mazda title, not even close to Indy Lights, and saying, hey, you want to go race Indy cars? Well, you don't say no, but at the same time, you also realize that if you had a little bit more time to gel and gestate and get ready, you'd probably take it. So, Steph's career is so long, we have done two parts of his life and career. We've done a couple of special features, too, that I'm going to roll out here soon during the holidays, but this is going to take four parts, maybe five. So for what we cover here, it is his life and times up through the end of the 1983 F1 season with that punch-you-in-the-face, brutal turbo-lag Honda engine in the back of the Spirit chassis. And from there, we pick up after that in our most recent podcast, which will come out soon. And then there's so much more to go after that in IndyCar, in F1, in sports cars, in GT, driver management with Stefan Johansson, Felix Rosenqvist, and you name it. So Steph's life, Steph's career, one of the most fascinating things you're going to come across. So I hope you enjoy part one here. Get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes. We also throw all these up on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. Everything lives on our Podbean hosting site, and I have gotten back in the habit of posting them on marshallpruitt.com. All right, here we go with the great Swede, Stefan Johansson.
Mr. Johansson, you and I have been trying to sit down and capture a podcast for how long, brother? It's been more than a year.
I think it's been over a year, yeah.
You need to slow down. Do less stuff.
I don't know. It's timing.
So you and I have known each other for a while. I've enjoyed our conversations immensely. And I always tell you, you've had what I consider to be one of the most amazing careers in motor racing. Folks might say, oh, he's done Formula One, he's won Le Mans. Those are great. Those are the highlights. But the list of holy shit cars he's driven, which is something we've touched on just in informal conversations. So I won't pretend that we're going to get through your entire career in one sit down. This is probably a two or three sit down thing. But let's start with the real basics of, tell me about growing up in Sweden and tell me about motor racing and if and when that was a part of your family culture, or did you find it?
No, it was very much my father who influenced it. You know, I was doing all sorts of sports when I was younger. You know, football. I mean, or soccer.
Yeah, yeah.
In this case.
What position?
Right wing.
Oh wow.
And right forward. But primarily ice hockey. I was pretty good at ice hockey, so I was right wing again. And I was I did that not professionally, but sort of just a level below, and the league right below the sort of Premier League or whatever you call it, until I was about 19 when I moved to England to do, you know, to try to pursue my career in Formula 3 then. So I did karting and hockey and all that stuff sort of simultaneously, you know, for all those years since I was about, you know, 8 up to 18.
Wow. And was the spirit of that adventure, was that a part of the Johansson household? What were your parents supportive of this?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I mean, my dad was racing, club racing, you know, and racing was, I mean, it was his life, you know. So inevitably, it kind of moved more towards the racing than the other sports, you know, at that point. And he got, you know, obviously I got my first go-kart when I was 8. And then I did that until I was 18, because you had to be 18 to race bigger cars in those days.
Those first kart outings, did it make sense to you what you needed to do? Was it because there's some people that learn the process, there are others that
just seem
natural?
The very first few times, not at all, actually. I was kind of really sucked at it, you know, because a couple of my friends at that age, 8 years old, came along, and they were way better than I were, you know. So, but then my dad kind of persevered, you know. And once you break through that first sort of barrier, then it became, you know, a lot easier. And obviously, you know, then I sort of got the hang of it, you know. So I got reasonably good quite quickly. And we had the little town I lived in was a very small town. It's only 30,000 people, but it was a huge karting sort of culture in this town. So we had probably about 30, 35, like really top level karters living in this town.
And,
you know, in the summers in Sweden, it's daylight till almost midnight, you know, so we used to be out at the local go-kart track till 11:30 at night, you know, racing after work when everybody's working during the weekdays.
Wow.
And if it was a nice night, everybody just loaded up and, you know, it took about half an hour to get there. And we just did our own little mini races, you know, in the evenings. It was great. Because I was, you know, 8, but I had a... So this is before I started racing. You couldn't race till you were 12 back then. So I had a 100cc kart, which is way bigger than you're allowed. And we were 50cc when you were 12 years old, you know. And because I weighed nothing, I mean, I used to kick everybody's ass when I was 8. Because I had like 40 kilos less to carry than the rest of them, you know.
But that must have been great training, though. You know, despite your youth and lack of size, being thrown into something bigger and powerful, more powerful than you would normally get at that age. I don't know. I'm almost foreshadowing your future here that, you know, big, fast things, you were introduced to that really early.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I mean, in relative terms.
Yeah,
of course. But, I mean, I think it probably helped to some degree, you know, there's no doubt about that. And I think what you discover early on is, you know, it's actually the more powerful and bigger the cars are, they're actually almost easier to drive, you know. Yeah. The more power you have, it's easier to drive the car with a throttle than it is with a steering almost.
The holy shit cars of your career. So were there drivers that you came up with just, you know, in Sweden where you're like, ooh, that's the measuring stick? Curious how you as a young driver were able to, I don't know if I should say benchmark yourself, but say, aha, these are some of, if I can fight with these guys, I know that I have something.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's always that, you know, and when you realize that you're, you know, on sort of level with them, then you kind of, it gives you the sort of, the validates your own sort of, you know, that, yeah, maybe I can be good at this, you know. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the big hero back then in Sweden, of course, was Ronnie Peterson.
Yeah.
You know, he was already unbelievable in karting. I mean, he did things with go-karts that no one could ever dream of doing, you know, and that just carried on. I mean, he was just an amazing car control and just an incredible raw talent, you know, and that showed up already in those early days, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, he was kind of the hero because his dad, he built the kart for Ronnie, and it was a very kind of unusual kart compared to the Italian karts that everybody was racing, you know, completely different kind of philosophy on the frame and everything, very simple, you know, but I mean, he was just amazing even in those days, you know, so he was definitely the hero from like, you know, very early years onwards, you know, until he, wow, until he passed away, really, I suppose, yeah.
So tell me about getting to a point to where you're now in your late teens and realizing that, okay, should I be a banker or should I be a farmer? What should I do with my life? Well, four wheels and gasoline, that's the direction for me. Where did that start to crystallize for you?
It started pretty early on. I mean, I dropped out of school when I was 15, you know, just wanted to sort of do pursue my racing, you know, and do that full time, really. So, you know, we did already, because then I was elected into the national team in karting in Sweden. You know, it's only four drivers per year that represents each country, you know, in the European Championships and the World Championships. Yeah. So, you know, that was kind of fully dedicated already then, you know, and then obviously then I kind of knew that's what I wanted to do with my life, I guess, you know, because I've never really had a job my whole life.
Brother, I don't think we call this a job, but yeah, yeah, everyone else listening and realizes you guys think you go to work each day.
Yeah.
Please.
No, I do realize that. It's funny, actually, if you go all the way back to, you know, when I was kind of semi-stopped racing, you know, and you try to, you know, you start your race team and you realize you actually have to work every day, which is a kind of a foreign concept, you know.
I have to do this? Damn it. Yeah. Where did I go wrong?
Yeah.
So what was the process of looking to where to go to advance your career? I mean, obviously British Formula 3, the kind of British ladder system, it was well known, obviously. Was that an automatic for you, or were there other championships you thought
of?
Well,
they were. I mean, the European Championship was almost equally as big or you know, prestigious then as the British was. But I think for me, that there was never really any doubt. I wanted to go the British way, you know, and do the British Championship and try to win that, and then, you know, progress my career from there. And I don't actually remember exactly why, but I think it was partly because AEL was a very good friend, you know, and he was about 2 or 3 years ahead of me all the time in his career. And he went the British way too, and I had at that point I had established sort of a small support group that and they put him in the British Formula 3 Championship with Marlboro sponsorship, and then I sort of got into the Marlboro program, you know, shortly after that. So it kind of was just a natural progression to follow him and trying to do the same thing, you know, and win the championship and then make something happen from there, you know.
So 1980, British Formula 3 champion.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you fighting against? Not just the whole roster, but I mean, but who are you fighting against where you said, this fight, this exchange, this, what I'm learning here, you know, this kind of process is the one that's going to really help me as I step into bigger and faster things?
Well, it wasn't so much that, I think, that you think in those terms. It was more just trying to beat everybody around you in that particular championship, you know. So the guys I was racing against in 80 when I won it was Kenny Acheson and Roberto Guerrero, mainly. And, you know, it was actually for Ron Dennis I drove at the time, you know, Project 4, before he bought McLaren.
Not a bad early relationship.
No, I remember he had this little space upstairs in the workshop. You know, we used to call it the fish tank, and there was this mysterious room up there with four guys sitting up there, and it was John Barnard, Steve Nichols, Alan Jenkins, and I can't remember they were tinkering with something up there. Of course, it was the first carbon fiber F1 car that all laid out, and it was all designed and everything up there. You know, before he pitched that to Marlboro, and you know. Then that was kind of part of the whole process of buying McLaren, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Sometimes we used to go testing. I had all four of them at the test in the Formula 3 car,
no
you
pressure.
Know. It's like
no
some
pressure.
Of the smartest guys in Formula 1 history, you know. Well, but they hadn't kind of broken
understood,
in, you know, at that point. So, but no, it was great.
You look
it was
back
really
now
cool.
And realize, how did you not piss yourself in the cockpit with those guys there?
That was good.
So you had, in terms of Formula One, I think most folks would think, oh, well, when things kicked off, you know, 83, 84. No, you actually, you know, had that unique birth while you were still going after your Formula 3 glory.
Mm.
Tell me about how, you know, maybe it wasn't everything you wanted it to be then, I imagine, but how did the, all right, kid, let's do the Formula 3 and also do a little bit of Formula 1. How did that enter into your world?
You mean with the shadow?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was a very strange circumstance, really. It was a guy who helped me a lot through my whole early career, and I mean, we're still very best friends, Chris Whitty.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the then team manager at Shadow.
Yeah.
And we literally just came up to make a visit just to sort of, you know, see a Formula One car and this and that, you know. So, and lo and behold, like 2 weeks later, the phone rings, you know, oh, we haven't got our driver sorted for Argentina yet. Would you be interested in doing the race for us? And I mean, I had literally not driven anything more powerful than a Formula 3 car.
Yeah, yeah.
I arrived on the, like 2 days before first official practice in Argentina, you know, never, not one lap of testing, poured the seat in the pit lane, and off I went for the first official practice, you know, with every one of my heroes all around me. I mean, I spent more time looking in the mirrors than I did on the track, I think. You know, it was a definite baptism, you know. And
when you're
on top of it, of course, the car was definitely not, sure, you know, in shape to be raced, period, actually.
When you're in the driver's meeting asking everyone else for their autograph, you know, you kind of...
Yeah, you know, it was pretty intimidating, I could tell you. But I mean, it was a great experience, but I was nowhere near ready for it, of course.
I was going to say, what was the thought process? Because obviously, you could have said no. You could have said, no, let me
hold
off. Yeah,
but I've never really turned down any drives, you know, as long as it sort of made somewhat sense. And I felt that at least the car was somewhat safe, you know, because... I mean, was, you know, you, as long as you're driving, you always create opportunities, you know. Mm. And I encourage every driver I work with for the same thing, you know. You're not going to get any drive sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring, you know. I mean, it's you're there, you're in the mix, you know, and you're as long as you do your job, you know, it's a good chance that, you know, somehow, you know, the connections are going to just kind of happen, you know.
You don't necessarily know where those connections are going to happen, but if you're not out there trying...
But my whole career has always been when you least expect it, and in the strangest places, just all of a sudden, it just boom, it happens, you know. And then, so you got to be prepared, you know. It's like Roger's famous quote, you know, when success is when your preparation and opportunity meet, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what it's all about, really.
So you make your Formula One debut, Argentine Grand Prix, remain with the team. It seems like you then feel the full weight of the car and its place on the grid by trying to make the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think Argentina there was just so much to take in, you know, that it was just kind of a blur the whole weekend because it was, you know, a lot at once. But then it was a doubleheader, so we went straight from Argentina to Brazil.
Yep.
And then Brazil, then, you know, you had a little bit more time to kind of integrate with the team and kind of understand, you talk to the guys, you talk to everybody, and then you sort of realize that, I mean, the team was on the brink of going under already. And I remember we had some parts flown in, and they had some strange Swiss designer I've never heard of before or after. I mean, don't know where this guy came from, but they had some new front suspension parts flown in, you know, for that race. And when I measured the car up, it turned out it was wheelbase was 2 inches shorter on the left side than on the front. they were designed wrong.
Is there an oval there?
No, not at all. It wasn't meant to be that way. But I mean, it was just a disaster, you know. So there, I kind of did, but you know, neither of the cars qualified, you know. So and I mean, the car was just, I mean, it was, you know, very, very difficult. So then I came back from there and kind of had to regroup. And then Ron, more or less simultaneously, I'd been talking to him anyway,
sure,
offered me the you know, proper, like, full-on, you know, like a really winning Formula 3 deal, you know, to win the Formula 3 championship. So I decided to bail out of the the shadow thing and do the F3 instead, you know, and try to win the championship and then kind of progress my career from there.
And it seems like that early taste of Formula One at least didn't put you off from stepping into a hard situation, right? Because if you think of most really talented young drivers who are coming up the ladder, if they're winning championships, you know, the mindset is usually, well, I want to go to a Ferrari, a Williams, some sort of big establishment. You didn't have your initial foray into Formula One turn into a bigger opportunity. It might be hard for someone to, I don't know if you want to say humble themselves, but say, okay, well, maybe I need to go back and do some more. Was that a hard mental transition for you, or did you treat this out of nowhere shadow opportunity like, oh, that was fun, but it was more of a side thing than a real launch?
No, I mean, of course it was, you know, I mean, it would have been nice to be able to carry on with a real program, you know, but I realized at the same time, I mean, it was, still, you know, that program was a hiding to nothing, you know, and it wasn't going to get any better. And as it turned out, they did one more race and then they were out of business. So, you know, I think had I turned down the F3 drive, I would have stood there with nothing and no results to show from the Formula One experience. So it would have, you know, been much more difficult, I believe, to make anything happen from then on, you know, in whatever category you were looking at. So
early 80s, Formula 3 and Formula 2, I mean, Formula 2 is a little bit of a forgotten beast. I mean, there were some
animals. Oh, that was
animals.
Fantastic championship.
Tell me about
a great
that.
Championship.
Tell me about that period, the cars, the drivers. It seems like something we should be celebrating more often.
Oh, so I think absolutely. It was an amazing championship back then, you know, super competitive, great drivers, of course, you know, across the board, really. And, you know, I mean, it was a big deal, you know. I mean, standalone events, we were pulling in, you know, huge crowds. I mean, it was 80,000, 100,000 people at Hockenheim when we raced there, you know. It was like a not short of the F1 race, you know. So, I mean, it was great racing, actually. It really was. It's a great period of racing, that whole era, I think.
Where did you start to feel like you were ready for Formula One? After, you know, further preparing yourself in the junior open wheel categories, I mean, by the time, you know, when you're done with Formula 2, are you feeling talent-wise, preparation-wise, maturity, like, okay, good that I've already had a sample of what F1 can be like, but did you have it feeling like you were ready to go?
Yeah, at that point I was. I mean, I won the F3, the British F3, and it was under pretty difficult circumstances, you know, because we chose the wrong car to start the season. The 1980-803 March was a real dud, you know. So Kenny, who was my strongest, he actually converted very early on to the 79 car, and, you know, which was a much better car. And then Guerrero was in the Argo, which was also a very good car. So it wasn't until, you know, in fact, we switched to the Rolt, which I had tested before the season started, and I knew it was a fantastic car. It was an amazing car. We tested it at Goodwood and smashed the lap record at Goodwood. But what I don't know the ins and outs, but I think Ron probably had a deal with March, you know, so it was kind of a semi-factory deal, so you had to stay with that, you know, and we tried everything that was humanly possible to make the car better, but it was just not a good car, you know. So when we switched to the Rolt with five races to go, I mean, mathematically, to win the championship, I had to win every race, get fastest lap, and pole every race to be able to win it, and which is exactly what we did.
You know, pressure.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, and you know, won with 1 point. You know, so it was. So I felt at that point that was pretty much. You know, I mean, I felt really good. I mean, you know, kind of when you're really, you know, on top of it. You know, when you're driving. And then, you know, I did the odd other bits and bits. Then, of course, nothing happened in Formula One for another couple of years, you know. But I did the F2 the following year and did well with that, you know. And then the year after with the Spirit, obviously. So then Honda chose me to be the driver when they went into Formula One in 83.
So tell me about that. Going from your F2, the Spirit team, and then this Formula One opportunity. Again, it Enzo Ferrari wasn't on the line yet, on the phone at this point yet in your career. Spirit Formula One team wasn't exactly setting the world alight yet.
No.
Tell me about how the conversations went to step into this Formula One ride, because, again, if I'm you, I'm looking at it going, okay, is this going to be another, would you be thinking, is this going to be another shadow type routine? Or?
No. I knew it was, I mean, I knew the people involved too, some pretty good quality people, you know, John Wickham and Gordon Coppock, you know, and I worked with them, you know, obviously the year before in Formula 2, and we were kind of the standard of Formula 2 at the time. I mean, we were very strong, you know, and the cars were really nice. I mean, beautifully built cars, you know, and we were the first sort of Bridgestone team. The tires were quick, but they kept blowing up and delaminating and all sorts. I mean, I think I had 7 poles the first 7 races, you know, so I mean, we were always quick, you know, but the results didn't show because we had a lot of issues with the tires that first year, you know. But through all that, you know, it was myself and Terry Bootsen, you know, who was the two drivers. And we did all, then when the Formula One thing started, they picked me to be the driver, you know. But we both did the testing during the winter. We did a lot of testing out here at Riverside and Willow Springs. It's where all the testing took place, the initial testing. Because Honda had their, you know, thing in Torrance, and we would base the car there and just kind of went to the different tracks from there, you know.
So tell me about entering into that. So obviously a good relationship built coming out of F2. Did the Honda folks, were they talking to you during that last F2 season about where they were going?
Yeah. I mean, we kind of knew halfway through that that was the plan, you know, to do the Formula One thing. And I sort of vaguely knew before we started even that the plan was eventually to go into Formula One. I think John had already mentioned that, you know, and they obviously knew because, you know, they were preparing all this along the way. But then, you know, things started to heat up during the season, you know, and so.
So legendary tales of amazing turbocharged 1.5 liter Honda horsepower and turbo lag like a donkey kicking you in the head.
Yeah.
I know you've been asked about this before, but good Lord, brother, it's some of the best. Tell me about your first experiences of dealing with this nuclear explosion of an engine with electronics and turbo lag that were nothing like we have today. What was that like?
I mean, it was, you know, it was pretty mighty. I mean, especially with, you know, with a Honda. Well, I mean, I guess they were all the same, but I mean, this was like really pioneering days, you know, because it was no one sort of done it before, you know, and they were fresh to everything, you know, all of it. So we did the first running at Willow Springs. Exactly. I mean, that last corner, you know, with all the, when the boost sort of kick on off all the way through the corner, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, it was a handful to say the least. I remember we used to come out of there with full opposite lock, you know, and on the exit in fifth gear, you know, and just the thing just lit up, you know.
And you go off and there are rocks and boulders. This is like an old West movie.
But it was so early days. I mean, you know, it was really, I mean, we rarely ran more than, you know, 5 laps at a time before we had to stop for a significant amount of time to do some either redesign of something, you know, or, I mean, it was, you know, early days of testing. So, you know, and there was no simulators or any of that stuff. I mean, of course, they had a dyno, but I mean, it was basic stuff, you know. So most of the stuff had to happen on the racetrack, you know. And then so it was like we were there for like over a month. I mean, you know, and then some days we had, you know, then went back to the shop and had to redesign stuff, you know, have bits flown in from England or whatever, you know, or Japan, and then we're back on it again, you know, and it was just, but that's kind of how you did testing back then, you know.
Did you enjoy that process? Obviously, we know where Honda eventually went in F1. You weren't there.
No.
You were years before when the absolute bottom of the floor is where you were starting from.
Yeah.
did you enjoy that process, or was it frustrating because there were...
No, I've always enjoyed that process, actually. I always loved testing, you know, and just kind of in, you know, really trying to be part of how you move the whole thing forward, you know, and obviously, you know, appreciating that my input, especially back in those days, were probably a lot more valuable than it is today, because you got so many things that you with sensors and this and that, and all the data that, you know, it's nowhere near as critical what the driver have to say, because we had to relay a lot of the stuff on just on everything, you know, that just you couldn't even measure back then, you know.
Jesus.
So
what is the testing and development process like to the point of saying, okay, maybe we should go race this? You would like to come into a brand new season saying, we're ready, we have confidence where everything is at. I don't know if that point was achieved, but it definitely felt like that 83 season was testing at some of the greatest circuits in the world.
Well, it was. I mean, that's exactly what it was. And I think Honda obviously knew that too, that this was very much a sort of a dip your toe in the water exercise, you know, before they get ready to go for it, you know. So, I mean, the team, you know, the car we had, first of all, was basically the F2 car.
Yeah.
I mean, it was exactly the same tub as the F2 car with, you know, an extra, you know, 900 horsepower compared to what the F2 car had almost, you know. Yeah, so, but, you know, but I mean, we all knew that, you know. So, I mean, I don't think it's a point to say, you know, now we're ready. I mean, you know, we knew that, you know, you start, the first race was going to be at Silverstone halfway through the season.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we were nowhere near ready, of course, for that. I mean, we did the Race of Champions, interestingly, you know, at the early part of the year at Brands Hatch.
Non-points.
Yeah, which was those non-points races they used to have every year, which was great, actually. And we showed up, you know, the car was at least 100 kilos overweight, if not more. And it was freezing cold. And I remember because no one else could get any heat in the tires. And we were blistering like the bees. It was like the medium compound. And we just like shreds left on them, you know, after five laps. So of course, we got heat in the tires. And the car was blindingly quick.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like second the first session, like quickest most of the, you know, I mean, we were right there, right on the pace. Qualifying, something happened with the engine. So we didn't get a good run, you know. But I mean, we were right up front the whole time. And I remember Dario Calzavaria was the team manager of Ferrari at the time. He was down there looking, you know.
And
to be honest, that's what planted the seed with Ferrari.
Hmm.
That first race, you know, like, who's this Johansson here? You know, it's like he's, you know, because, I mean, they, of course, they'd heard of me. But, I mean, you know, until you're actually there in the thick of it, you know, it's a different story. Yeah, I used to blow the doors off Keke, you know, and all these guys with the way. I mean, it wasn't for any other reason that we had, you know, probably 40 degrees more heat in the tires than anyone else was able to get, you know. So,
but if they, you know, pulled you out of the car, they might have made weight, but that's the only other thing would.
So we started. Actually, we sort of started chatting a little bit, you know.
Mm.
Took my number, and so it was sort of a light communication from that point on, you know. Every now and then, but
so tell the race, me about. I was going to say, tell me about the race. You already, you know, already spoken about this shadow experience of being a kid, you know, surrounded by your heroes.
Yeah,
there were still many heroes there, but I have to imagine, even though you knew that this was, you weren't in a car that was going to be bothering the podium. I was going to win that race. Well,
in
my
mind,
I
was
I
ready
you.
To win it. I was ready to go. I mean, and I think we could have, to be honest.
We
would have been able to, yeah. But, you know, when good old Hadji, you know, was in charge of the whole engine program. There's no electronics, no buttons or anything to turn the boost up or down. I mean, you know, he was there, like, before they put the engine cover on ropes. Gave it a couple of turns extra, you know. I was like, come on, let's do. And of course the thing fucking blew to pieces after about three laps, you know.
Well, what is that like? And again, I ask this because we talk about, you know, Neil Armstrong going to the moon and this person going to the depths of the oceans. There are only so many human beings on the planet Earth that have lived, that have strapped into a Formula One car with 1,000+ horsepower and just had all the blood drain out of their face because this thing, once you mash the throttle in a straight line, what is that feeling like when you've got Haji cranking up the boost knob and you go out to start the race and go, oh my, I mean, I have to imagine it's that Star Wars, you know, Star Trek light speed experience almost.
Well, you've already gone past all that. You know, you don't think about that. You just want as much as you can get. I mean, that you always want that in a car, you know, whatever you can get. You just, because you're so in tune with the car and what you do, you know, you just want more and more and more, of course. That's the whole thing, you know. I mean, it's, if you, you know, you can give you another 1,000 horsepower, you'll take it, you know.
1,000? I
and
want
you deal
to.
With it. Yeah, that's what I mean. If you already have 1,000, you want another 1,000 if you can. I mean, it's just, you know, whatever you can get to make yourself go faster. I mean, that's...
I may be more fascinated.
The speed thing and all that, you get used to that pretty quick, you know. It's just figuring out, you know, you just kind of dialed into to what you do, you know, and then.
But I have to believe that is a very, very rare human capability. I think you could put any person in a 1,300 horsepower Formula One car, and while very few of them would go quickly, they could adjust to some of that extra speed to some degree, but not the. I'm going to be flat and to the last possible moment in the braking zone, have everything happening so quickly, having to almost look three corners ahead to predict what's coming because it's over like that. That ability to process, to have these things hitting your eyes, hitting your ass, hitting your hands and feet, process all that and be on pole or be, you know, wheel to wheel with the Sennas and the Prosts, that mental ability, that's a talent that either is exposed or not exposed. What was that like for you in that initial phase of testing a car that has so much power? Is that something that, at least again, early, initially, it was a shock, or was it something that from your past experience you could absorb and thrive in?
No, you absorb it, you know, and you sort of get used to it all, you know, and then, I mean, you never want the car to be driving you. You know, you want to be driving the car and you want to be on top of the car. But that, I mean, that's just what we live for. I mean, when you're on top of the car and you're completely in control of the car, no matter what beast it is, you know, how much downforce it has or how many horsepower it has, that's what a racing driver is all about. That's what makes you tick, you know. I mean, to be 100% in control of the car and everything. At that point, everything slows down to almost like a slow motion kind of thing. You know, you're totally in control of everything.
And that's crazy.
You can do the dial. You can, you know, you have a full power slide, and you can still adjust. You know, because at that very moment, you want something else to happen. If you have tools at your disposal in the cockpit, whatever, you know, you use it, and you can still manage to do all that while and that's kind of what it's all about. You know, that's what makes it all worthwhile, when you're that state of mind you're in, when you're just so in control of this beast, you know, it's an unbelievable feeling that it's hard to describe, but that's what makes a racing driver tick, I think.
You're fucking insane, yeah. And I love it. So that slow motion zone, is that something that for you, because as we'll get into, and we're going to have to stop this here shortly and save this for a next installment.
Yeah,
is that slow motion zone, is that something that happened and happens on its own? Is that something where you have to warm up to that before, again, because it's the crazy dichotomy of you're in essentially the fastest racing car on the planet with things happening in milliseconds, yet your brain is turning this into a slow motion movie so you can handle it. I don't know. I've never been there. I probably shouldn't. Most people shouldn't. How does that happen, though, for you?
Well, it's to a degree, I think it's what makes a great driver or not, or a good driver compared to a mediocre driver to a great driver, a good driver to, you know, the really good ones, you know. You have that capacity to do that, you know. But a lot of it is also, you know, you can train yourself to do it, for sure. The more you run, you know, the more you get into that state of mind, you know. But that's, I have to keep talking about this state of mind, but that's really what it is to, for me anyway. That's why I'm still racing to this day, because I just love to be in that space, you know. It's just an amazing feeling that is better than anything I've found in in my life, you know, whatever it may be, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's just an amazing space to be in, you know. Unfortunately, these days there ain't many beasts around anymore. Yeah. So, you know, it's a pity, really, because it really does change your whole approach, you know, because now it's a totally different thing. You have so much shit in the car that can help you, and you got, you know, and the tracks are, relatively speaking, not very challenging anymore in the sense that what they were and back in the 80s, you know, that if you do fuck up, at best case, it's going to be painful, but, you know, worst case, it could be a lot worse than that, of course. Yeah. So, you know, which makes a difference, you know. I mean, it really, even when you open up a corner like Eau Rouge, for example, you know, when you have you're facing a wall going in there, as opposed to like a, you know, 200 meter field, the depth perception, the visual thing is a completely different thing, you know, and it makes you a lot braver, just not having to look at that wall when you turn in, you know. So the corners sort of become almost a non-entity now because of that, you know, in any type of car. It's a, you know, 50% easier corner than it used to be.
Well, let's just close on 83. Retirements with the car, not unexpected.
Yeah.
Did have one good result, almost top six, you know. Yeah. Got back then, you know, the way it worked.
Well, that was the other thing. I mean, it was brutal back then, because, I mean, you know, to get any point, you had to finish six, which is not easy, yeah, as you know, in a Formula One race. At the best of days, you know. So,
but I'm just thinking of this car, with this, you know, rolling explosion of horsepower behind you, at the Österreichring, or the Zandvoort, or wherever else. I don't know if it did everything you wanted in the corners, but I know that you were doing everything you could to extract performance from it. Was there, you know, even though there wasn't champagne and glory with this, you know, debut half season, so you're getting applause from people outside, were you able to at least enjoy, or did you have an ability to enjoy what you were doing, knowing that you didn't have a winner beneath you necessarily, or was there a sense of frustration of, well, shit, I don't care, I want to win?
No, it was absolutely total joy, you know. I mean, it was great, you know. I mean, we finished the first race, you know, and I mean, I was driving the car to the best of my ability, you know, and hanging it out there every lap, you know. And I mean, that's the funny thing, you know, with racing. I mean, obviously you get this question a lot, you know, but I mean, some of my best races, and I think you can ask any driver, and they say the same thing, is when you've been fighting for 10th, you know, driving your absolute heart out, you know, but just on the day, the equipment didn't give you more than that, you know. But that doesn't mean you don't, you know yourself, when you do everything you humanly can with that piece of equipment you have at your disposal at the time, you know. And some of the best battles I've had with some fantastic drivers has been duking it out for 12th, you know, and just not leaving one cent on the table, you know. I mean, you just absolutely giving it everything you got, you know, and changing places and fighting and banging wheels and doing everything, you know. But it's just, that's what it's all about. You know, for me, it's always been more about being in the moment, you know, just relishing what you have, because it's such a wonderful thing, you know. And when the stars line up and, you know, you got a great car, and then you win, you know. I mean, I feel that I've always been able to deliver. Every time I had a winning car, I've been winning races. I don't recall I've ever not got the job done, you know. But that's the battle for all the drivers, all of us, you know. I mean, you got to get in the right car at the right time, and that's, I mean, look at Alonso. I mean, he's still the best driver in the world, I think, you know. And he's been stuck in inferior equipment now for way too long, you know. But I mean, he's obviously still enjoying his racing. There's no question about that.
Well, we're gonna hit the pause button here at the end of 83, where a young Swedish kid, I think, makes a reputation as someone who isn't afraid of anything, isn't going to give up if he just because he doesn't have a car that's ready to win yet, and is showing folks that he's, you know, a gunslinger who's going to be coming for heads. So we'll save getting into 84, 85, and all the amazing stuff that followed for our next installment. But Steph,
all right.
Brilliant brother.
Thank you.
And that was Stefan Johansson. I'm probably going to have to break out that part about testing a Formula One car, turbocharged Honda Formula One car, at the rocky, crazy, bust a hole in the bottom of the tub if you even slightly go off Willow Springs course. I mean, it's truly among the many last frontiers in motor racing. One frontier that's never visited Willow Springs is safety. So just not as if Formula One cars haven't tested there before. There is a small but rather famous history of that taking place, but in a recalcitrant car with the Hammer of God engine that just, I cannot believe that he held on to that thing or tamed it around Willow Springs without destroying the car before the motors blew up, of course. Just another great, great tale from Steph. Got some other fun tales that I have set aside and will be rolling out here. One of them is for my new series, The Strangest Car I've Raced. And so Steph shared a Formula One car that certainly fits that bill. And we have another one from Steph that I saved, Classic Racing Stories, that, Lord, again, some of these things might not be new to you if you are an old Formula One fan, but I'm constantly reminded that our new fans are being built every day. And that some of these stories, especially the ones that date back to the 80s, before the internet was a thing, might just be new to you. All right, well, Steph's a gem. I hope you enjoyed this. Part 2 is a lot of fun, and I'm not going to wait too long to put that up, so that should be coming here sometime soon, hopefully early December. And then there's some more Steph tales and stories to come as well. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thanks for listening.